and not works is the basis of our vindication from our guilt. Habakkuk 2 verse 4 says that the righteous will live by faith. Those in right standing with God live by that principle of faith. And Hebrews chapter 11 verse 6 says that without faith it is impossible for us to please God. That the only way that we can bring God delight is by faith. We could go on. It's hard to escape the centrality of faith. So what does that mean for us to live by faith? What does that look like in real life? Not in the stained glass illumined religiosity of halos and harps, but in the real world, like the woke up late, kids are whining, what to have for dinner world. Like on the job, what does it look like for me to live by faith at Fast Track? Or in my family, what does it mean for me to live by faith as the father of a high school graduate and a son just a few days past sophomoric, and the other two? And what does faith look like as the husband of a hottie, the most beautiful woman in the world? Because those are the kind of questions that I face. What faith looks like in my real life. So for that, I need a model, like someone who can show me what it looks like to live by faith. Someone who can mentor me, show me what real faith looks like in the world. And we find that perfect mentor in Abraham. Abraham, who Paul called the man of faith. So, over the next couple months, if you're with us, we're going to be looking at the story of Abraham, a story that is built on the framework of God's visits with this man. Seven times in Genesis, God visits with Abraham. And we're going to look at each one of those visits, each one of them teaching us a principle about the life of faith. Over those 7 minute visits, we'll get to see a relationship developing. In those 7 visits, there's progress, there's parallelism. And we'll see that in weeks to come. But it all starts in Genesis 12 with God's initial visit to Abraham. It's God who initiates the relationship, breaks the silence, makes that first awkward attempt at conversation. The Lord said to Abram. God opens the line of communication. He does what Abraham never would have on his own, nor would we. Romans 3:11 says that there is no one who seeks God. No one. God is always the initiator in the relationship. 1 John 4:19 says that we love him because he first loved us. His love is primary, ours is derivative. We love because of his love for us. But while God takes the initiative in this, he doesn't take sole responsibility. He's not alone in this. Abraham has a role to play. If Abraham wants a relationship with God, it will not be one-sided. God may speak first, but Abraham has to respond to build that relationship. And what we'll see is that over these 7 visits, Abraham's role expands. But even here, this first visit, Abraham is not just to sit on his hands. Begins with an invitation or a command, really, but it's not one delivered with heavy-handedness. It's just one command. Go. and then developed with three phrases. He is called to leave his country, his relatives, his father's house. Each phrase more intimate. It's adding punch to the command. From country, which is a reflection of geographical region, the familiar landscape, knowing the roads and the landmarks, a place that feels like home. To a people, a reflection of an identity, a culture, the familiar customs. To father's house, reflection of his closest relationships, siblings, aunts, uncles, cousins, direct relatives, the familiar family. Family was the primary source of safety and security and identity in the world. Families would stay together later on two separate occasions. First, when Abraham's son Isaac, and then when Isaac's son Jacob are ready to marry, they are sent back to Haran to find their wives, because that remains the base of their family long after Abram has left. So going for Abram was no simple matter of relocation. This was a difficult uprooting. It required him to tear himself away from the familiar and the secure. God initiates. Abraham must respond. This isn't one-sided, but it also isn't balanced, because Abraham's given one command. He's to go. And that is far outweighed by the heaped up I wills that reflect God's promises in this. The on balance means that most of the responsibility falls on God, that he will take the heaviest responsibility. But this pile of I wills, it's all grammatically linked to that one command to go. In other words, God's faithfulness to his responsibilities, all these I wills, is contingent on Abraham's faithfulness in going. If Abraham refuses to go, then the I wills from God will shrivel to nothing. God is saying, go so that I may. God's pile of I wills boil down to this: blessing. The word for blessing in Hebrew is used five times in these two verses. I'll make you into a great nation and I will bless you. I'll make your name great and you will be a blessing. I'll bless those who bless you. And whoever curses you, I will curse. And all peoples on earth will be blessed through you. If Abraham is willing to let go of his current circumstances, circumstances that are favorable and familiar, circumstances that reflect a home and a family that provides security and stability in life, then he will find something better than that, better than favorable circumstances. He'll find divine favor. The favor offered by the circumstances are the very things that we tend to cling to, that we tend to get wrapped up in. And God is inviting Abraham to let go of that in order to pursue God and his favor, his blessing. And this divine favor, interestingly enough, sounds like it makes up for what he's called to leave. The promise is that he will be made into a great nation to compensate for the land that he's left behind, and that he will have a great name to compensate for the family that he's left behind. If he lets go, then God will chart his way through all of this uncertainty and will secure for him the very things that he has let go of, reward him. In so doing, God will give him a land and a family, only better. Better than what he let go of. So the superlative, a great nation, a great name. But actually, it gets one step better than that. I mean, better than great nation, better than great name. Hard as that is to believe, verse 2 and verse 3 end with this assertion, each verse, that not only will he be blessed, but that he will be a blessing. As if God offers him the carrot to appeal to his self-interest decision making. Great nation, great name. He'll get that. God will give him those things back. He will prosper if he takes the risks and let go. It will be good for him as an individual. And there will be no regrets when Abraham looks back over his life. He will not be disappointed in the choices that he has made. And God delights to do that to us, to shower his blessings on us. He wants to fill our lives with blessing. He just doesn't want that to be our priority. Because there's more to it than that. Matthew 6:33 says, "Seek first his kingdom and his righteousness, and all these things will be given to you as well." All these things. What you eat, what you wear. God can take care of those things. So don't chase them. God is nudging us to see that there are better things than good circumstances in life. That God's blessing is better than that. And it'll push us even further to say that there is something even better than God's blessing. As if that's possible. I mean, what could be better than God's blessing? How can you beat God's blessing in your life? Well, even better than that is being a channel of God's blessing. Being one through whom God's blessing touches others. To be that channel of blessing presupposes God's blessing on you personally. But it doesn't stop there. It will pass through you. Blessing so full that it overflows. Overflows the banks. It spills over. So much so that everyone in proximity to you gets their feet soggy in the overflow of God's blessing, too much to contain within you. And the ultimate promise here for Abraham is that all nations will be blessed through him. But to experience that, he has to let go. The clarity of the point of his departure from the land is matched by the murkiness of the destination. To the land I will show you. That's where he's to go. To the land I will show you, which seems wildly undefined. I mean, leave all that's familiar to you and go somewhere. God is expecting him to let go of everything familiar and to set out for a destination that at this moment is not only unfamiliar, it's unknown. He's not even sure where he's going. It's just enough for him to follow God's path. East, west, north, south. Where will be revealed by God when it's necessary for him to know. It's not until verse 5 that we find out that he leaves for Canaan. But initially, all we get is, "To the land I will show you." Alexander McLaren puts it this way. He had to fling away substance for what seemed like shadow to all but the eye of faith. The familiar, undeniable good of the present had to be waived in favor of what common sense calls a misty possibility in the future. And then he says this, "To part with solid acres and get nothing but hopes of an inheritance looks like insanity. Go is plain. To the land I will show you looks like the doubtful outlines seen from afar at sea, which may be nothing but clouds." How? How can he trade solid acres for mere hopes? Well, the answer is faith. Hebrews chapter 11, verse 8 says that by faith, Abraham, when called to go to a place where he would later receive as an inheritance, obeyed and went, even though he did not know where he was going. Did not know where he was going. To the land I will show you. Uncertainty. He doesn't know where, but he does know who. God will show him. And by faith, in confidence that God can be trusted, he obeyed and went. We're told his age, that he was 75 years old, not the time that you'd expect a major uprooting in your life starting over. But this is God's plan. He takes his wife, his nephew, everything he owns, and then the journey from Haran to Canaan is summarized with a simple sentence. They set out for the land of Canaan, and they arrive there. That's it. No details about what they encountered during this trip, the hardships, the headaches, the dangers, the delays, as a trip of 600 miles surely had. Just that they set out and arrived. And that's all we need to know. That he obeyed. That he went. That he let go. Because the significance is not in the details of the journey. It's in the fact that he made the trip at all. The question, I mean, the real tension is, will he obey? Will he let go of all that is comfortable and secure in life, everything that is familiar to him, and go to an uncertain place with this promise of God's blessing? And the answer is yes. He will and he does, because he's exercising faith. To give us more details about the trip itself would cause us to get bogged down in this travelogue and possibly miss the point. So the spotlight is focused squarely on this issue, that of letting go. And here's the first principle we learn from Abraham. In the life of faith, how it relates to my life. Faith lets go of favorable circumstances to grasp the favor of God. The life of faith is willing to set aside the comfortable and the familiar, to say, this is what I've known, but it's not necessarily what I need. Faith is willingness to go through the uncertainty, leaving behind the security blankets that we've assembled, to live between the promise and the blessing for a time. And to believe that God can be trusted with that. Now understand, letting go of favorable circumstances does not necessarily mean that they'll be lost. I'm like fascinated by dragonflies. In fact, years ago, I thought I was going to be an entomologist, a guy who studies bugs. And then I got into high school science and realized I wasn't a great science student. But I just like bugs. So I have this display case of all of these dragonflies that I've caught. Probably 15 different species, and I've got them male and female next to each other and kind of pinned on these boards. Anyway, it's just a fascination I have. And the way that I catch them is with a net that Sue made me a number of years ago. And for the most part, now I just catch them and release them. So I catch the dragonfly, pull it out of the net to identify it. Well, to pull it out, you just grab it by the wings. When I have it held by the wings, there's no possibility of escape. So I'll pull it out, take a look at it. Usually it's something I've caught before and I know what it is right away. If not, I can look it up in my guidebook. But after I'm done identifying it, I let it go. But usually I just set it on my shirt or on the bill of my hat. And once I release that dragonfly, it's free. It can go wherever it wants. And it is amazing how often that dragonfly just stays right there. Like wherever I've put it, it'll just stay on there as a perch. It's probably shell-shocked. But it may stay there for 4 minutes, 5 minutes. It might even fly off and then come back to that same perch on my shirt. And eventually it might fly off. But the reality is that even after I've let go, it doesn't mean that it immediately flies away. And this is what we have to learn in our own experience, that letting go of favorable circumstances doesn't necessarily mean that they'll disappear, that God will strip us of them. It's just the reality that I no longer have to clutch those things. That those things can come and go as they please. I may not lose them, but I'm also not beholden to them to find my satisfaction. I enjoy them when they're there, but when they're gone, well, that's okay too. Because at best, favorable circumstances, even the best of circumstances in your life, are only secondarily satisfying. Ultimate satisfaction comes from God's favor, not from any circumstantial benefit. So, we have to make this distinction, subtle but necessary, of enjoying but not grasping. When circumstances are good, we enjoy them. We're grateful for the familiarity, the security. But when they're gone, that's okay too. Favorable circumstances can be a gift from God. The steady income, the familiar places and routines, the peaceful sleep in my own bed, the climate-controlled homes and cars and offices and stores, the diners and the places that I like to go out to eat, the long holiday weekend with cookouts and campfires and sun and sandals. It's all good. Good stuff. Things that should be enjoyed but not grasped. When decisions in life are made primarily to preserve or enhance favorable circumstances, I'm not just enjoying, I'm grasping. When I compromise my convictions, and usually just by cutting a few corners, in order to improve my circumstances, then I'm not enjoying. I'm grasping. When my emotional well-being, my personal state of contentment and satisfaction are dependent on circumstances, and that I find myself depressed or irritated or anxious in response to a dip in those favorable circumstances, then I am not enjoying. I'm grasping. And the tighter we grasp to those favorable circumstances, the looser that we hold to the blessing of God. I mean, if that's what you want, like life in Haran, living among family, carrying on the family business, content with grain stores and four solid walls and a ceiling and a familiar commute and a landscaped backyard and your favorite restaurants and ice cream at Northern Lights or Benny's, would take your pick, and possessions, lots of possessions like cell phones and Fitbits and boats and cars and iPads and walk-in closets to store it all and storage space and vacation homes and collectibles and hair care products and tools and Michael Kors bags. And if that's what you want, you can have that. The best of favorable circumstances. But that's not the life of faith. And that's not the path to blessing. Divine favor, God's blessing, is so much more than circumstances being good. And the blessing of God is worth the trade-off. And this is where we need the help. To trust that His blessing really is the best thing to grasp. To believe deep in my heart that His blessing is more real and more substantive and more satisfying than all that He calls me to release. Abraham found that it was. And it still is. God's blessing, better than anything circumstantially that you could cling to. So go from your land, your people, your father's household. Let go of the familiarity and the security of favorable circumstances. Loosen your grip. Trust God. And take hold of His blessing. That would be the highest priority in your life. Let's pray. Father, I know in my own heart that struggle, that tug of war between, boy, a real superficial desire for good circumstances in my life and your invitation to pursue your blessing. And so, Lord, I pray for myself, I pray for each one of us here that we would long to be blessed by you so much so that we would let go of all the circumstances that are to our benefit. Trust them to you. Believe that your plan is best. And follow you and pursue you with all our hearts. Lord, Abraham becomes a model of that for us here in just this first step of a life of faith. Lord, I believe that he has more to teach us in these weeks to come. But today, that lesson is what we need. That reminder that we are called to let go of favorable circumstances, to grasp your favor. So, in this week, Lord, I pray that you would open our eyes to see what that looks like in our decisions and in our priorities and in our attitudes. Lord, I pray that it would make a difference in the way that we live our life. It's in Christ's name we pray.